Hebrews chapter 11, in that reading that we just had, contains what is ironically one of my favorite verses in the whole of the Bible. By faith, it reads, they were sawn in two. I don't know about you, when I think of the rewards of the life of faith, I tend to think of things a little bit more positive than that, a little bit less, well, gory, to be honest. The author of the letter to the Hebrews doesn't have any illusions about the life of faith. Doesn't have any illusion that those who follow Jesus will find things easy, will be spared from trauma, will be spared from sadness. That they will always find reliable blessing in this world, that everything will go well. That isn't his experience, and it isn't the experience of those he writes to. Without missing a beat, the author moves from women received their dead by resurrection to others were tortured, suffered mocking and flogging, chains and imprisonment, stoned to death, sawn in two, killed by the sword. They went around in the skins of sheep and goats. Strange rewards for faith. A strange advertisement, to be honest, for the life of faith. Yes, there were also in this reading great heroes of faith who conquered kingdoms and won great victories, but there were others who lived lives of poverty, persecution, torment, homelessness, imprisonment, mockery, torture, execution. It's not exactly an advert. One thing the author of the book of Hebrews wasn't gifted at was sales. It's all far too truthful. It's far too realistic, far too balanced. It's not making the case for the life of faith on the basis of the rewards we will have here. But as you probably know, for the readers of the book of Hebrews, the first readers of that letter, that came as no surprise. They were under no illusions as to what life would be like following Jesus. Those things described by the author, that was their life. They lived under persecution. They were excluded from the synagogue. They were excluded from much of the life of their community. They were scapegoated by Jew and Roman alike. They were a persecuted minority within an oppressed nation. They knew that their faith in Jesus would not spare them from the realities of life, would not spare them from the suffering. And so they could identify with these stories from their history, these stories of the women and men of faith who had come before them and had suffered. Some who had suffered for their commitment to faith, others who had just suffered because that happens in life. And those readers could draw strength from the sense that as they themselves suffered, they did not do so alone. For the author moves from Hebrews chapter 11 to Hebrews chapter 12, which incidentally must be one of the worst places in the whole Bible that a chapter break got inserted. You probably know that the chapters and verses aren't in the original text. They didn't come along until the 13th century. And here, that change from chapter 11 to chapter 12 completely breaks the flow and cuts off the punchline. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that lies before us. That imagery, that picture of the great cloud of witnesses, I've often heard it spoken of as describing one of the great athletic events of the day. The crowd gathered in the stands cheering on the athletes as they compete. But it's actually rather unlikely that that's the image intended by the author. For the Jews of Jesus' day, the athletic events that were beloved of the Greeks and the Romans were completely alien to the Torah, to the Jewish way of life. When the Greeks, under Alexander the Great, first conquered the ancient world, the author of the Book of Maccabees, the Jewish historian, if you like, of the day, wrote in despair that the Jews built a gymnasium in Jerusalem in the heathen fashion, disowning the Holy Covenant and allying themselves with the heathen, becoming slaves of wrongdoing. To participate in one of those athletic carnivals was, for a Jew of Jesus' day, an act of idolatry. It was taking on the values and the ways of the Greek and Roman conquerors. So it's very unlikely that the author writing to the Hebrew church would have been encouraging that image in their mind. Perhaps best to get that image of spectators cheering you on out of the mind. It might be comforting, but it's also a little bit egocentric. The crowd there to watch you, to watch us, as if we were the centre of the story. The great cloud of witnesses spoken of aren't spectators. They are witnesses. Like in a court of law, they are witnesses. They are there to speak their testimony of the things that they have seen and heard. The Greek word that's translated there as witnesses is martus, a term for those who speak out about their faith, especially for those who died as a result, from which, of course, we get our word martyr. Not spectators watching what we do, but witnesses to what Jesus has done. The author of the book of Hebrews isn't appealing to us to do our best, to do well, because the crowd is cheering us on, but is encouraging us to look in the same direction as those witnesses who have gone before us, those people of faith who have gone before us, looking as they did to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and took his seat at the right hand of the living God. So yes, the author reminds his readers, when we suffer, for our faith, or when we suffer for being alive, we have the example of those of the faith who have gone before us. Those who, despite not receiving what was promised, persevered as witnesses to God. But more than that, he wants to say to us, we have the example of Jesus, who also suffered. Who suffered the rejection and loss and betrayal and ultimately unjust execution. And walked through it all in confidence of the promise set before him. In confidence of the joy that awaited him. The place in the presence of God. The difficulty, I guess, always, in passages like these, is how we find meaning for them in them for us, for ourselves. When Stuart Powell preaches often in the evening, he quite often explicitly uses this structure for his sermon. Stuart will always tell you at the beginning of his sermon what the structure of his sermon is. He'll often ask, what did these words mean for them? And what, therefore, might they mean for us? It's a good approach, actually, to the Bible, recognizing that the words had different meanings in the context and culture and time and place of their first writing. And asking how they communicated there and what that message might be for us. And it seems to me that as we move these words from the first century Hebrew church to the 21st century Australian church, the big shift in context we might need to make is that unlike them, we are unlikely to be persecuted for our faith in God in anything like the way that they were, or anything like the way that the heroes of faith in Hebrews 11 were. Like them, we will suffer the hardships which simply come from being people in a fallen world. But unlike them, while we might be scorned or laughed at or worse, pitied or favored with puzzled looks, we are unlikely to be actively persecuted for our faith. We are very unlikely to be sawn in two for it. We face a different set of challenges. So perhaps we don't need so much to be pointed towards the way that Jesus endured the cross, scorning its shame. That image of unjust persecution, which was so powerful for them. Perhaps if the author were writing to us, he might instead see and refer to the other challenges we face. He might allude to the temptation that we face to focus our time and our energy on material gains and the comforts and the luxuries of life. Perhaps the same author writing to us might say, let us run with perseverance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who lived with nowhere to lay his head, sharing his life with others so that they might know the love of God. Or perhaps seeing the struggles and pain of everyday life, he might write, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who wept for the loss of his friend. Or perhaps he might see the struggle that we have for status and advancement and rights, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who was offered the kingdoms of the world, but chose instead the integrity of service. Or he might look at our desire to be popular and to fit in and to avoid the scorn of those who think us weak-minded because of our belief in God, and right, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who endured the scorn of those who were wise in the eyes of the world and chose the simplicity of grace and hope and love. We don't, generally speaking, persevere through physical danger because of our faith. But the struggle to persevere in faith is no less real for being less explicitly life-threatening. We are called to persevere through hardship, through temptation, through distraction, through the ever-increasing complexities of modern life. Most of all, perhaps, we're called to keep our eyes, our focus on the life that God has called us to, the life that Jesus modeled, when there are a million other voices calling for our attention, a thousand other things that we have to do, good things, important things, genuine responsibilities. So let us run with perseverance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer, the perfecter of our faith, who through all the competing demands of life kept his eyes on the prize, kept his focus on the reign of God, on the life lived in love, focused on Jesus. We have a much better chance to keep our priorities right. Amen.